Good afternoon. You're listening to KTOO. I'm Yvonne Krumrie. Thank you for tuning in. Anchorage parents could be held legally liable if their child brings a gun or other deadly weapon to school under a proposed assembly ordinance. East Anchorage Assembly Member Karen Bronga introduced the ordinance. She says in the past three school years, the school district has confiscated dozens of deadly weapons from students, like knives and hatchets. She says officials have found roughly five firearms a year in the same period.
When I first looked at five, I'm like, well, that's kind of small, but it's kind of big because of the imminent danger that that presents.
If the assembly passes the ordinance, prosecutors could charge a parent or legal guardian with a Class A misdemeanor. If their child brings a deadly weapon to a school and there's proof that they provided the child with the weapon or allowed them access through negligence. Bronga says the school district has done a number of initiatives in recent years to lay out responsible gun ownership and the importance of safe storage for firearms. But legally, the city can't mandate that storage.
We're not telling you you can't have these things in your home. We're just saying if you have these things, that you need to check your kids because we can't charge them in a felony because of state law, but they will have a Class A misdemeanor if they show up at school with a dangerous weapon.
If convicted, the parent or guardian could face up to a year in jail and up to a $25,000 fine. There are caveats to the liability, such as if the parent or guardian reported the weapon stolen or had it stored in a reasonable manner. A school district spokesman declined to comment on the ordinance. In a statement from the Anchorage Police Department, officials said the ordinance contributes to public safety and responsible firearm ownership. And quote, this holds parents accountable if they allow a child access to a firearm brought onto school grounds. Bronga says the ordinance will likely be voted on in early April. Lawmakers heard last week that they're facing even larger deficits than they previously thought. As Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports, that's complicating a key priority for majority caucus lawmakers in the House and Senate, boosting funding for public schools.
After one hearing and with little discussion, the House Finance Committee has put a high-priority bill that would substantially boost state education funding on the brink of reaching the floor for a final vote. But it's also facing stiff opposition from minority caucus Republicans.
I can tell you right now, I don't see any way that the legislature under our current fiscal regime has any way to meet these obligations if this bill were to pass.
That's Fairbanks Republican Representative Will Stapp questioning the sponsor of the House's top education funding bill, said independent Representative Rebecca Himshute. The bill would boost education spending by more than $325 million next year, with additional increases the following 2 years. A few days earlier, lawmakers heard some grim projections about the state's finances. Between the current year's budget and next year's, legislators are short more than $530 million to maintain what is essentially the status quo. Senate leaders say dipping into the state's main savings account isn't on the table. Senate Finance Committee co-chair Senator Lyman Hoffman, a Bethel Democrat, says it would be irresponsible to spend the savings account on what are typical operating expenses. And Hoffman says that leaves lawmakers with few options.
If we're going to meet our obligations, we need to, I believe, address new revenues.
Major revenue measures, though, have been few and far between. The only bill to get serious consideration so far comes from an unexpected source, a conservative minority caucus Republican senator. Wasilla Senator Robert Yount filed a bill that would expand the state's corporate income tax to cover so-called S-corporations. The bill is widely expected to apply to just one taxpayer, Hillcorp. Yount says it's all about leveling the playing field. So-called C-corporations like ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips pay state income taxes, but S-corps don't.
It's real money. I'm here to count pennies, nickels, right, dimes, quarters, and dollars. And an average family of four in Alaska right now, this one loophole is over $700 a year.
For the state, it would raise $185 million in its first year and $125 million the next. Members of the largely Democratic bipartisan Senate majority welcome the proposal, but it's unclear whether it has support in the House. Which brings us back to Stapp's question. How are lawmakers going to pay for a boost in school funding? Education bill sponsor Rebecca Himshute's answer was essentially that they have no choice. The state constitution obligates legislators to fund public schools.
At the end of the day, everyone in our state deserves, has a right to a high-quality education. We're going to have to figure it out.
That led Stapp, a minority caucus lawmaker, to do the legislative equivalent of throwing his hands up in frustration.
I'm interested to hear what the majority's proposals are to be able to fund the bill, but I will absolutely bite. I know this is a big priority for you guys, so Mr. Co-Chair, with the permission of the committee, I'm going to go ahead and see if I can move the bill.
And he did. At its first hearing, the bill passed out of the Finance Committee with no opposition. That leaves it on the brink of a final House floor vote. But when it might come up for a final vote, if ever, is an open question. Shortly before the bill moved from the Finance Committee, Governor Mike Dunleavy said the standalone funding bill, quote, does not have my support. Representative Andy Josephson, an Anchorage Democrat who co-chairs the House Finance Committee, says for now, the majority is holding out hope that lawmakers and the governor can come to an agreement.
Cynics might say, yeah, but they won't bear fruit. But we're told that they may very well bear fruit. And we want to get, as I noted in Finance Committee, to a win-win with the administration.
But even if a compromise is reached, it'll still take money to pay for it. And back at the Senate Finance Committee, lawmakers are steeling themselves for some tough choices. Here are Senators James Kaufman, Lyman Hoffman, and Jesse Keel.
I think we need to add scissors to this tray of equipment on our desk.
Red pens, maybe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Keel.
Or Zoloft.
They've got a little less than 3 months to figure it out. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
And an investment by the Alaska Permanent Fund in the seafood processing company Peter Pan was supposed to be an investment in Alaska, but it ended in failure to the tune of more than $29 million. That's because Peter Pan collapsed, resulting in the closure of the fish processing plant in King Cove, its main economic engine. Nat Herz with the Northern Journal, in collaboration with ProPublica and the Anchorage Daily News, recently wrote about the Peter Pan failure. He told Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove that an investigation revealed that the Permanent Fund leadership and its hired firm, McKinley Capital Management, either missed or ignored some warning signs that Peter Pan was a risky investment.
The job that McKinley, the finance firm, was doing on behalf of the Alaska Permanent Fund was basically going out and looking for companies that sort of had growth potential or were undervalued and that they could sort of buy into and generate more money and sell it off at a big profit. And so one of the companies they ended up focusing in on was this Peter Pan Seafoods, which was like a longtime corporation that bought and processed and sold the catch of Alaska fishermen. So they have this enormous plant in King Cove, this small community way out there on the Alaska Peninsula. They had a few other plants kind of scattered across the state. So the idea here was, okay, we'll put new money into these plants, like buy new processing equipment maybe and buy more seafood and raise the level of revenue and throughput in the plants, and then we'll have like a much bigger sort of book of sales and we'll be able to sell the company for a big profit.
I mean, that sounds great. So what's the problem with that?
Well, it does sound great, but generally speaking, the seafood industry is like a really chaotic and volatile industry where you kind of have like boom years and bust years. And so the idea that you could sort of easily build your revenues up and just sort of sell it for a profit, like this is a cutthroat industry. It has a lot of other existing players that are trying to maximize profits. And the other thing that really happened here was you had this kind of overall meltdown in global and Alaska seafood markets. And so like this reformulated Peter Pan like ran right into that.
It sounds like there were some red flags that were missed, but did you see anything in terms of like, I don't know what, actual malfeasance or anything else shady?
The short answer is no. I mean, I think that's been a lingering sort of challenge to the reporting. I think, you know, certainly people in King Cove are really quick to blame this really colorful seafood industry player, Roger May, who's like a very wealthy, you know, kind of flamboyant guy who produces Hollywood movies and hunts for buried treasure and just like seems to have all kinds of money everywhere. And actually through sort of this receivership sort of bankruptcy like process, ended up with a lot of the company's assets. But I think, you know, you kind of have everyone pointing fingers at each other. Like, I think the Permanent Fund points fingers at McKinley and says this was a McKinley deal. You end up with McKinley and the other of the three partners in the business deal pointing fingers at Roger May and saying it's his fault. Roger says, it's not my fault. I loaned the company a bunch of money and lost a bunch of my own money. But the fishermen, meanwhile, like they're mad and they don't feel like there's been a lot of accountability either. But I don't think sort of we are at the place where we can conclude that sort of any one thing was to blame so much as like there was a constellation of things that appear to have contributed to this collapse.
I mean, you mentioned the fishermen in King Cove and that they would be upset by this, but it goes a little bit further than that, right? I mean, in terms of the economic impact in King Cove, and I wonder if you could tell me about that.
Yeah. So one of the major sort of reasons I think I was drawn to this story initially was that you had fishermen who went out, caught fish, or had, you know, paid to like upgrade their nets and fix things and get their boats out on the water. And we're going to go fish for Peter Pan. And then Peter Pan all of a sudden closed down the plant and said, yeah, we, you know, still owe some of these fishermen money from past catch that we bought and sold, but we don't have any money to pay them. So you've got fishermen out like tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. And beyond that, this is a community that is built on commercial fishing. You know, the huge chunk of King Cove's tax revenue comes from taxes on the catch that's delivered to the processing plant there. It's like a huge employer in the community. It's like a huge sort of anchor tenant for like all these municipal services, power, water, etc. And so without it, you're seeing like families moving away, like the enrollment at the school has like fallen. You have like the potential for them to ask like the state for, you know, aid, basically a bailout. And I think sort of what is really ironic, and another sort of reason I felt like this was really a story that Alaskans needed to know about, was like, we kind of did this to ourselves, right? Like a state investment that like ended up going bad is now leading to, you know, maybe like the slow, or not even so slow, death of this community, and a situation where like actually they may need to be coming back to the state for like more money. And I think that's, you know, whose fault that is and why exactly it happened. I mean, I think those are actually really important questions that like we should be asking ourselves, given that, you know, this happened, if not because of decision, public policy decisions that we made, certainly like connected to public policy decisions.
That was Northern Journal reporter Nat Herz talking to Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove. You can find the full story on ADN.com or at northernjournal.com. And it's 40 degrees and raining this afternoon in Juneau. You're listening to KTOO. For more news, go to ktoo.org.